I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and you're listening to Writers on Writing. My guest today is Benjamin Percy, author of The Unfamiliar Garden. On the show, we talked about writing series, outlining, marketing, and so much else. Enjoy the show. So, Ben, talk about The Unfamiliar Garden and the inspiration for it.
Sure. And let me also say thank you so much for having me on.
Oh, it's great to talk to you.
I have sort of two elevator pitches to share at the same time. One has to do with the Comet cycle, of which The Unfamiliar Garden is a part. So I've been writing for comics for either DC or Marvel for several years now. Fall of 2014 is when I made my comics debut. And as much fun as it is to be writing characters like Batman or characters like Wolverine, I recognize that I am a custodian as opposed to a creator. And I wanted to build my own shared universe. So the Comet cycle is triggered by an age-old sci-fi concept. You know, a comet comes streaking through the solar system. The planet spins through the debris field. The meteor showers that follow introduce new elements that shake up the laws of biology, geology, physics, upset the geopolitical theater, and, you know, create sort of innovations in the energy and weapons sector. And in a very Marvel-y sort of way, there's a new dawn of heroes and villains. So all of these books in the Comet cycle, in these initial three books anyway, and this could be six books, it could be nine books, it could be 20 books. It's an ever expanding universe, but these first three books all happen at the same time in different parts of the world. So that you can jump in, and we can talk later maybe about the whole marketing idea behind it, but each of these books is standalone in that way. You can read book three before you read book two before you read book one. So even though The Unfamiliar Garden is book two of the Comet cycle, you can dive right in. And the idea behind The Unfamiliar Garden is this. The Ninth Metal was rather expansive. It was an ensemble story. I wanted to narrow the focus here. And it is a he said, she said story. There are two principal characters. And when I say a he said, she said story, I was inspired by, you know, Lauren Groff's Fates and Furies, by books like Gone Girl or shows like The Affair.
Yeah.
Where you have these differing perspectives that are somewhat unreliable in their perspectives. But here's the he said, she said of it all. You have, on the one hand, this guy who is a mycologist, a professor at University of Washington. You have, on the other hand, this detective with the Seattle PD. Now, they used to be married, and their relationship was a bit troubled then, but the thing that drove them apart, the thing that drove them to divorce, was that on the night that the meteors fell, their daughter vanished. And, you know, the cleavage between them, the chaos, the wound that resulted, is just too much. And so 5 years later, we're catching up with them, and he, the mycologist, is studying a new strain of fungus that is popping up in the Pacific Northwest. The Pacific Northwest, meaning Seattle, Puget Sound, the Olympics, which is a great place for, given how damp it is out there, for new things to grow. And she, the detective with the Seattle PD, is investigating a series of ritualistic murders. Now, it turns out that these two things are intertwined. And so they are brought back together professionally before they are brought back together emotionally for a possible reconciliation, in part because we learn maybe their daughter is actually still alive.
Mm-hmm.
So that is the quick and dirty summary of both The Comet Cycle and this book, The Unfamiliar Garden.
Mm. Well, I haven't read any of your other fiction works, and found it really interesting that, you know, what you just said, that there are three books, and I am always curious about series and whether I need to start at the beginning. And yeah. I like your explanation about why it's not necessary, nor did I even feel that I was missing out on anything by reading this one, first of all.
Yeah, and there's, you know, I pitched these books as a whole, and part of that pitch was not just the story, but also the rollout. You know, I look at series, and as much as I love them, there's a basic marketing reality here. And that is that the second book, the third book, the fifth book, they sell fewer copies than the first. There's a trick. So I was trying to fight that. But I was also looking at how, you know, other models might inspire me. And those models include books like those that Lois Lowry wrote, right? She has The Giver, The Messenger's Son, Gathering Blue. And they're not so much a quartet as they are a family. Or look at Elizabeth Strout. She's got Oliver Kittredge and Anything Is Possible. Or Kate Atkinson has Life After Life and A God in Ruins. And Marilyn Robinson's Gilead is not referred to as a sequel to Housekeeping, but basically is. And none of these books are dependent on the other. Though they build on the same narrative fabric, they rub up against each other, like a kind of, you know, I said family before, bestiary, or however you want to refer to it.
You know, I didn't realize that about series, that, you know, the subsequent books after the first don't do as well. I didn't realize that.
So I'm, you know, trying to fight a trend there. And that trend is, you know, it's not that it's impossible to overcome. There are exceptions, of course. But, you know, I'm also looking to comics as a model. I mentioned I'd been writing for comics for some time. And one of the things that I think that they do that's so smart is they come out first as floppies, right? They're $2.99 for an issue, $3.99. And as a result of that, you have cheap, wide distribution, which builds word of mouth. And there's nothing more valuable than word of mouth. And people will take that risk, right? They'll pick up something that costs $3 without thinking twice about it. And then later, five of those issues are collected into a paperback. And then later, those five issues are collected into a hardcover. Probably has some extra stuff in it, some bonus material. And then later, not just those five issues, but probably 12 to even 20 are collected into a deluxe omnibus edition.
Sure.
Now, I've always felt that the publishing industry has it a bit backwards right now, in the way that, you know, you put out a book that costs $37 sometimes.
Right.
As a hardcover up front, that's very exclusionary. And if I, somebody who is a total insider, if even I am like, I think I'll wait for the paperback.
Mm-hmm.
What is, you know, your average person who's a more casual reader think? So I insisted on, as part of the rollout, that these books in the Unfamiliar Garden, the Ninth Metal, the next one, the Sky Vault, we're going to come out in quick succession. Sure. But also they were going to come out as paperbacks first. I was trying to flip the model so that after the three books come out, they will be collected into a deluxe omnibus hardcover, more of a collector's item that has, you know, a few extra short stories, an essay, maybe some illustrations in it. So all of this is to say, I'm trying to be innovative, not just in the way that I'm telling the story. And this whole Comet Cycle was an experiment in that regard, but also just in the way that it is rolled out, you know, in its marketing platform.
Hmm. So the publisher must have a lot of trust in you to go with this, right? I mean, you know, usually authors are on the side of, you know, nobody's listening to me. They want to do it their way. They like their title, their cover, their everything.
Sure. And, you know, I'm in the privileged position of having been in the business for a while now.
Yeah.
So, and also having, you know, my fingers in a lot of pies in that I write across mediums. You know, I write comics, I write screenplays. And when I say screenplays, I mean features. And, you know, I'm doing a lot of television now. I write for magazines. I write podcasts. So I have sort of like a craft knowledge, which I'd be happy to talk about, you know, more broadly, that sort of extends beyond just the prose you see in The Unfamiliar Garden, you know, all these different storytelling devices that have sort of added to my arsenal, but also just sort of an understanding of the business itself.
Yeah. Yeah. Which, I don't know, I guess with writers, or maybe with all artists, the business side of things isn't as fun or appealing. And so often we almost don't want to know.
Oh, really? I'm totally into it. I'm plugged into it, and I'm fascinated by it. And it informs a lot of my creative decisions.
Hmm. And you live in Minnesota, yeah?
That's right. Yeah, I grew up in Oregon, but I live in Minnesota. I'm married into the Midwest. My wife's family, they're dairy farmers. And we wanted to be close to one set of grandparents or the other when we had kids. So yeah, live in Minnesota. Love it here. Reminds me a lot of Oregon, actually, except that the Pacific Ocean has been replaced by an inland sea in Lake Superior. But yeah, this is where we've set up shop, and where I, you know, really wanted to stay for the long run, because I wanted my kids to have deep roots in a place, which I moved around a lot as a kid and don't have that feeling of being anchored in any one school, community,
yeah,
you know, friends.
Hmm. Are you also a fungi or mushroom expert? Because you know a lot. I mean, I feel like I was also getting an education reading The Unfamiliar Garden.
Well, I always do a deep dive into research and everything that I write. And you know, if you look at my book, Red Moon, that's a book that tackles werewolves, but in a unique way. I was trying to come up with a scientific analog to the werewolf myth. And so I spent a lot of time with researchers from Iowa State University and researchers at the USDA labs. I filled up, you know, a dozen yellow legal tablets with information to help authenticate the fantastical. And that same sort of mindset informs The Unfamiliar Garden. I spent time with a biology professor at Carleton College named Dan Hernandez. I spent time at the Wolf Ridge Environmental Center in northern Minnesota. Even took a fungi class. So there's that. There's that intentional research and reading a bunch of papers, scientific papers, and so on. But also, you know, my mom, and this is just incidental research, you know, the accidental research that sometimes happens to you. My mom is trained as a botanist. She worked for the Forest Service. And to this day, I have never met a bigger nature nerd. You know, she is truly obsessed. She sees the world in a different way than anyone else. When she walks along, it's all about plant life. You know, you can't go more than five steps when even walking the dog before she pauses to look down at something and, you know, fires off its Latin name and tells you a dozen different ways you can use it for medicine.
Sure.
And so, yeah, I mean, to get into some of the fungus stuff, like most people think that blue whales are the largest organism on Earth, but they're wrong. It's a fungus,
yeah.
A pathogenic fungus that takes up estimated 3,000 acres in eastern Oregon in the Blue Mountains. And it's estimated to be over 8,000 years old And, you know, the Pacific Northwest is this garden. And botanists have tried to find the edge of this thing, but there is no edge. It just keeps expanding. And on the surface, you see these yellow-capped honey mushrooms pop up. But beneath the soil, there's these rhizomorphs, and they're just slowly fingering their way outward, you know, filamenting outward, and they're weaving tighter and tighter together, and they're forming this kind of mat below the surface. And the digestive enzymes from this thing, they kill the things, the enzymes it secretes, they kill conifers. So I have stood over this thing outside of Joseph, Oregon. You know, I've stood in a dead forest that this mushroom ate. And there are all these yellow cap mushrooms popping up all around me. And then there are all these skeletal trees. And, you know, that was in part an inspiration here. That image just soaked into my brain. You know, that was 10 years ago. And finally found its way onto the page here. Except that communication, that coordination, that growth is occurring in the human population instead. And if you think about the way in which this otherworldly fungal organism is using people as an adaptive vessel, you know, there are no aliens in this book. There is an alien singular, the mycelium network, the fungus that's spreading among us, that's creating a united intelligence in the situation that reads, I guess you could say, like a contemporary version of Invasion of the Body Snatchers.
Mm-hmm. Do you have the book there? Are you able to read from the beginning, read for a few minutes?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, that would be great. I'd love to hear you read from The Unfamiliar Garden. And I should say it's also published by Mariner. And that is, Mariner is a part of what? Let me see, Houghton Mifflin, Harcourt.
That's right, which recently got gobbled up like a fungal organism by Harper. So yeah. It's kind of a squishy place to be right now. I'm not really part of Mariner. It's actually published by William Morrow, even though Mariner is on the spine right now. It's weird. It all happened sort of in this quickly transitional way as the book was rolling out.
Yeah. Okay, let's hear it.
You got it. I'll just read the prologue.
Okay.
It begins with a comet. Decades ago, an infrared telescope captured the thermal emission streaking through the solar system. Eventually, it was determined to be 300.2 kilometers wide and orbiting the sun in an elongated ellipse that would bring it within 500,000 miles of Earth. The moon, by comparison, is 238,900 miles away. This would be, scientists said, a beautiful light show that everyone should enjoy all the more, knowing that we'd narrowly escaped planetary annihilation. The official name of the comet was P/2011C9, but most people called it Kane, the surname of the astronomer who discovered it. 20 years later, it burned into view and made its close pass by Earth. People took off work. They gathered at soccer fields and in parking lots on rooftops and along sidewalks, setting up lawn chairs and picnic blankets and grills and coolers as though readying for a fireworks display. Everyone suddenly owned a telescope. Vendors sold Comet t-shirts and hats and keychains and plush stuffed toys. Surfers stacked up on beaches waiting for the big waves they believed would come from the gravitational flux. At least two cults killed themselves off, announcing this was the end of the world and the comet a gateway to the vault of heaven. Professors and scientists and religious leaders became regular guests on cable news shows where they talked about how comets had long been associated with meteorological and human disasters, tsunamis, earthquakes, droughts. In 44 BC, when Caesar was assassinated, his soul was said to depart the earth and join the comet flaming overhead. In AD 79, a comet's arrival aligned with the eruption of Vesuvius in AD 684, when Halley's Comet passed by, the Black Death broke out, and in 1066, when it made another appearance, William the Conqueror won the Battle of Hastings. Celestial judgment and providence, or an instrument of the devil, as Pope Calixtus III called it. Heaven knows what awaits us, one professor said. It is a reminder of our irrelevant smallness and accidental existence in the universe, a glimpse of something violently outside the bounds of human existence. As close as you can come, you might say, to seeing God. Local news reporters interviewed people on the streets. I don't know, it's just kind of cool, one man said. Special, once in a lifetime sort of deal. You want to be able to say, I was there. It's almost like we're living in this two-dimensional life and now there's this sense of it being three-dimensional or whatever, if you know what I mean. Cain looked like a roughly drawn eye, some said, or a glowing animal track, or a slash mark in the fabric of space, a wandering star. For a few days, the comet made night uncertain, hued with a swampy green light. And by day, the sky appeared twinned with suns. And then, gradually, the comet trailed farther and farther away, and people forgot all about it. Until 1 year passed. The planet finished its orbit of the sun and spun into the debris field left behind by the comet, the residue of Cain's passage. This June, the sky would fall. That's what the newscaster said. The meteor shower was not as long-lasting as August Perseids, but for several nights, the sky flared and streaked and wheeled, the constellations seeming to rearrange themselves with ever-shifting tracks of light. At first hundreds, and then thousands, and then hundreds of thousands, and finally an uncountable storm of meteors. The ground shook, windows shattered, grids of electricity went dark, satellites shredded, radio signals scrambled, dogs howled, people screamed their prayers. Many of the meteors dissolved in the atmosphere, but many struck the earth, sizzling into the ocean, splintering roofs, searing through ice, punching craters into fields and forests and mountainsides like the seeds of the night. It was then that everything changed.
Oh, thank you so much. Before we talk more about the book, I have to ask you if you've ever done voiceover or, you have it nailed, right? All the characters and you have the voice.
I've got, a background in theater.
Yeah.
In high school, college anyway. And I did do the audio book for my novel, Red Moon.
Oh.
I will never replicate that experience again, though. That took two weeks in a recording studio.
Reading.
Reading. Comedy. I mean, I love reading, but imagine reading silently for 8 to 10 hours a day. That's exhausting, right? Then try doing it out loud. It was a workout.
I'm going to have to check it out now. But I was curious, as I was reading, and of course the ending, which we can't talk about. We don't want to do any spoilers at this point, but how much did you know in what was going to happen? Are you an outliner? I mean, do you have it all scoped out? What the book's going to do and what's going to happen in every part?
Generally speaking, what I do is I have a scroll of paper and I tack it to the wall. And at the top of the scroll, I have an overall concept. So that concept might be, post-apocalyptic reimagining of the Lewis and Clark saga. That's, my book, The Deadlands, or whatever. I have the concept of the title up top. On the left side of the scroll, I have characters, a character chart. And I scroll down their names, of course, but also kind of Wikipedia entries on each of them. And then sometimes a drawing as well that I might cartoon out. And then once I figure out who these characters are, I am able to figure out what they want. And when I figure out what they want, I can put obstacles in the way of that desire, like a cruel god. And there are the first stirrings of plot. So out of these character bios on the left side, I start to have these strands, these plot strands reaching across the scroll of paper. And I don't know every single thing that's going to happen because that would be boring. But I do know the big moments. I know big action set piece moments. I know big emotional moments. And eventually what I'm going to do is put another scroll underneath the first scroll. And that's when I start to figure out chapter breaks. That's when I think to start to think carefully about, you know, okay, how do I want to move back and forth between all these characters? How do I want to end chapters on moments of emotional or physical peril to keep people hanging? And what is my midpoint reversal in the book? What is a rock bottom moment in the book? What is going to be the summit of the story? And I'm sort of going through that like sheet music and thinking about, you know, ups and downs. Think of it like a cardiogram or a suspensometer. Like, okay, this is a low moment, this is a high moment, and so on, and the variation between them. But overall, you know, when it comes to knowing your end when you begin, because I, you know, I'm looking at this thing sometimes for a year, building this thing sometimes for a year or 2 years before I ever start to hit the keyboard. You know your ending when you begin, and everything is like an arrow hastening towards the target when you start to write. But again, I don't want to know everything. So I give myself room for improvisation. I guess you could say that these outlines are written in pencil instead of pen. And one way I like to think of them is as a constellation. Because if you think of that, a constellation, and I guess this keeps in the theme of the comet cycle. If you think about a constellation, right, you look to the sky and there are these stars with a lot of dark space between them. And it's through that imaginative projection that you're able to find a shape in the story. So here I have these bright points in my narrative, and I'm navigating the dark space between them. And that improvisation allows me, when I'm writing the story, to feel like it's new, even though I've been thinking about it for so long and planning it for so long.
Interesting. Are you thinking protagonist, antagonist, all that?
Yeah, you know, I was talking earlier about how comics have taught me a lot and how all the mediums I work in have taught me a lot as a writer. So to answer your question and just talk about comics for a second, you know, comics are strict in many senses. You have 20 pages. You don't have 18 pages. You don't have 24 pages. You have 20 pages if you're writing for Marvel. And there's an A plot, a B plot, a C plot, and a D plot. And the B plot of one issue becomes the A plot of the next. There are 5 to 7 scenes. There's probably a splash page. In other words, a splash page is a single image that takes up a whole page. There's probably a splash page in the first 5 pages. There's definitely one in the last 3 pages. What I'm talking about is a kind of skeleton or formula, you could say. But, you know, you think about poetry for a second. Here's what Terence Hayes, the poet, has to say about form poetry versus free verse poetry. Free verse poetry says, you know, it's cool if you can break dance, but it's badass if you can break dance in a straitjacket. A straitjacket being like a villanelle or a sonnet. Mm-hmm. And I feel like writing comics is like writing, is like breakdancing in a straitjacket in a way. In that there are these constraints, but the constraints can be inspiring. Now, you look a little closer. What are some other things going on in comics? I could talk about that for 4 hours, but just to home in on one thing in particular, you mentioned protagonists, antagonists. Mm-hmm. In comics, we call those heroes and villains. And I know that comics are a bombastic technicolor version of storytelling. So let's look at what comics are doing and then subdue that when it comes to fiction. So in comics, and this is actually a statement that goes beyond comics. Most villains are either a opposite or a dark mirror of the protagonist or hero. You know, again, to get out of comics for a second, like think about Sherlock Holmes. Sherlock Holmes's principal adversary is Moriarty, right? Moriarty is basically Sherlock Holmes. He's a dark mirror. He has the same exact skill set. He just uses it with ill intent. Look at Indiana Jones. You know, the dark mirror of Indiana Jones and Raiders of the Lost Ark is Belloc. He is a trained archaeologist, incredibly smart, but he uses his skill set to seek out power and money, whereas Indiana Jones is always saying, this belongs in a museum. So, you know, let's look at comics now. Like, you have these characters who are opposites and dark mirrors, but what really matters is that they are externalizations of internal wounds and internal weaknesses, problems. So there's no better rogues gallery than Batman. So look at Batman for a second. The core wound or key insight, that's the term thrown around in screenwriting, of Bruce Wayne is that when he was a kid, he left the theater with his parents, Thomas and Martha Wayne, and they walk through the very aptly named Crime Alley. And they were set upon by a mugger, and, you know, a gunshot rang out, and it's now infamous now, the image of those pearls, you know, torn from the mother's neck and clattering the asphalt. And little Bruce Wayne in the end is left in the rain with his dead parents beside him. And that moment of trauma, right, gives rise to the Batman. And the Batman is trying to bring law and order to Gotham to fight back against the chaos that he experienced, traumatizing chaos he experienced in that moment. Now, who embodies that best? The Joker. Joker is chaos. But look at some of the other characters and how they represent different facets of Bruce, such as Dr. Freeze. If you're writing a Dr. Freeze story, it should be about Bruce's emotional coldness. If you're writing a Two-Face story, a Two-Face story should be about, is Batman the mask and Bruce Wayne the man, or is Batman the man and Bruce Wayne is the mask? If you're writing a story about Scarecrow, Scarecrow is a character who, like Bruce Wayne, was, you know, suffered a fearful incident in his childhood. His father was experimenting with fear serums. He was a crazy psychologist, psychiatrist who was experimenting with fear serums and experimented on his son. And in the same way, like Bruce Wayne fell through that well and into a cave below Wayne Manor, and all those bats attacked him. Bruce Wayne like has weaponized fear. The fear he felt then he weaponizes against criminals in the same way that Scarecrow weaponizes fear except to do evil, right? So in other words, I'm talking about all of these different antagonists or villains, however you want to think of them, and thinking about them as, you know, a way for the protagonist or hero to overcome some emotional gauntlet. Like they're overcoming a physical gauntlet that is epitomized in this villain to overcome an emotional gauntlet and arrive at the other end changed. And that is exactly how I'm thinking about my novels, except in a less, let's say, you know, crazy Technicolor way, even though my novels are pretty crazy.
You know, I saw the villain or antagonist of The Unfamiliar Garden to be fungi.
Yes and no. You know, you can think, I mean, without too many spoilers involved, there's it turns out that there's different types of fungus, and some are cooperators and others are, and this is true of our world as well, right? Some are necrotic. In other words, they break things down and they eat things up. They gobble things up. And others are cooperators. And that's true of, you know, the forest floor. If you look beneath the forest, you see a mycelium network that's equivalent to a kind of internet. Mm-hmm. And trees are able to speak to one another through it, you know, to warn of danger, fire, whatever, disease infestation. But they also offload chemicals and exchange chemicals through it. So if like a tree is about to die, it will dump all of its chemicals into the mycelium network and transfer it to other trees, right? So there are these cooperators and there are these necrotic fungi. And that is true of the book as well when it comes to this alien fungus. So some are, you know, it's a little more complicated than we first think when it comes to like, oh, this alien organism is bad.
Right.
But the real enemy, I'd say, is, you know, the government agency that's trying to weaponize this.
Right. Yeah. Now I'm kind of rethinking the book and thinking I need to read the other two. But
well, one thing too, just from a craft perspective, I always want to have like a, and this is how it relates to fungus. I always like to have like a craft goal in mind. I was talking before about how, you know, I wanted to write this he said, she said book. And it's more than that. One of the things that happens is you have the he said, she said, but eventually these two characters come together. And I wanted to reach a third person plural. I wanted there to be, and here's where the fungus comes in, a symbiosis. A union, a convergence, so that by the end it wasn't he said, she said, it was instead they. So that's my, you know, just a nerdy craft goal.
Yeah, no, that's interesting. I actually, you know, really made me want to go to the Seattle Forest, which I've never been, and like I need to make it up there.
Yeah, I know, you know, the Olympics, I would especially recommend. We spent about 2 weeks there a few summers ago. And yeah, for fungal growth alone, it's beautiful, but there's also just like so many creepy crawlies there. So many, you know, underworld mushrooms popping up in every direction. It's an epicenter for it.
Yeah, and I didn't realize that, you know, there's like a whole cadre of people out there looking for them because they are selling them to restaurants and...
Oh, yeah, in the Pacific Northwest. I mean, it's a hot item, selling to restaurants, and also there are just wars. I know this seems crazy, but like things get violent out in the woods between the foragers who are all very protective of their territories.
I wanted to ask you about categorization, because you've touched on it a bit, but, you know, when I started reading The Unfamiliar Garden, because I'd only read Thrill Me, your essays on fiction, which I loved and recommend all over the place, I didn't know what to expect. I don't like to read reviews before I go into a book, because that always influences me, and I wasn't really sure what the genre was when I started reading. It's like, is this literary fiction? Is this science fiction? Is this speculative? Are you thinking of categories? Is that something that you're concerned with or aware of as you're writing?
So to draw off of Thrill Me, you know, I grew up on comic books, and I grew up on genre novels. I grew up reading about dragons and vampires and robots with laser eyes and barbarians with woolly underpants. And when I walked into my first college classroom, I was told by the professor, who looked like a mannequin, he was hairless and expressionless, very forbidding. And he told everyone, you know, there would be no genre in this class. And, you know, I looked around at everybody and then put up my hand, and I very earnestly asked, like, but what else is there? Because I'd never read James Baldwin or Alice Munro or Raymond Carver or Leslie Silko. But in the semesters to follow, you know, all that was assigned was literary fiction. All that you could write was literary fiction. And I fell in love with it, but I never fell out of love with genre. And I ended up, you know, it's kind of a complicated journey, but one landmark moment was I picked up this collection, this anthology years later called Thrilling Tales. And it was edited by Michael Chabon, and had an all-star table of contents. And the point behind it was he invited all of these writers to write the kind of story that they would have loved when growing up. So, you know, Jim Shepherd writes a story about a giant shark, and Nick Hornby writes a story about a VCR that can see into the future if you fast forward the tape, and Kelly Link has some witches and fairies in hers and blah, blah, blah. And I found the collection sort of hit or miss, but I love the just joyous experiment of it. And it really resonated with me, this question. And I was just a fledgling writer, a baby writer then. It's like, well, what if I had been invited to write for this anthology? What kind of story would I have written? And I realized then like how I had sort of lost my way, like what made me want to be a writer I had lost touch with. And I realized I was sort of most interested in those writers who were neither fish nor fowl, both literary and genre. And I'm talking about writers like Margaret Atwood or Susanna Clarke or Kate Atkinson or Ursula K. Le Guin or Michael Chabon, Peter Straub, Dennis Lehane. You know, like, where does Cormac McCarthy belong in a bookstore? You've got Child of God, which I would say is horror. You've got The Road, which is post-apocalyptic. All the Pretty Horses is a Western. No Country for Old Men is crime. Sutri is literature with a capital L. I don't know. It doesn't matter. The taxonomy doesn't matter. You know, what I'm most interested in doing is trying to write stories that are artfully told, but compulsively readable.
It's a good way.
Yeah. I'm not sure. I know that people are very neat, freaky, and they like to be able to just put something in a box. But I guess my books kind of resist being put in a box.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which is also the strength, I think, of what you're doing.
I mean, yes, it's got some crazy sci-fi stuff going on, but it's really a family story.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, you know, I don't know if you went through an MFA program, but it seems that so many of them are really, you know, built for the literary writer. And if you're doing genre fiction, forget about it.
Yeah. I mean, I would say that the tide is changing slightly. You know, I'm 42 now. So when I went through an MFA program in my 20s, like, it was a different world. It's a little more accepting these days to be, you know, a Kelly Link or a Dan Shaun or a Karen Russell. But there is certainly a lot of snobbishness out there and a misplaced belief that literary realism is the norm, where if you look at the long hoof mark trail of literature, that is not the case.
Yeah, really true. You know, I want to, before we have a few minutes left, and I really want to talk about Thrill Me, based on fiction that I read. When did I read it? I think it came to me around 2016. Looks like that's when it was published. And I love it. I continue to love it. And so I'm looking through it. I've marked it up quite a bit, especially the chapter on urgency. I seem to have marks all over the place. And there was something I went through it again recently, and you said something about repetition, which I loved. You talked about the Godfather, in the Godfather, it's the orange, and Lolita, it's bubblegum, meaningful repetition or rhyming action.
No.
I don't think I have read anything about repetition in quite this way as you have in this book. Can you talk about that? Just setting stories up, setting meaningful repetition, setting it up.
Yeah.
Why it's important.
I mean, you see this in poetry, you see it in fiction too, you see it in film, you see it, you hear it in songs, the way a chorus, you know, cycles in and out. And every time you come back to that chorus, it usually rises in volume and, you know, might increase its tempo and certainly carries more emotional weight as the song progresses. So the way a repetition works in fiction, I mean, it can take a number of of different tacks, but one of them, you know, you already mentioned The Orange and The Godfather, is the objective correlative. That's what Ezra Pound called it, I believe. The idea that there's this object that you invest with meaning over the course of the story. So in The Godfather, every time an orange appears, somebody dies. You know, Sonny gets whacked after you pass by a billboard for Florida oranges, or Don Corleone, you know, knives apart that orange in the garden and pops a slice in his mouth and starts to chase his grandson around, and then he slows his pace and hitches his breathing and collapses, a heart attack. And so, you know, it becomes like this fruit becomes a harbinger of doom. And look at the way that Dumbo's magic feather, right, cycles through that story, and how it usually comes to a point, like a juncture where something happens to the thing, like the feather, in other words, is cast away, and there's this realization that Dumbo can fly without it. Or in the things they carried, you know, Lieutenant Jimmy Cross, all throughout the story, there's been these love letters from Martha that he's been reading in the foxhole, and they come up again and again and again and represent his fantasy life as he separates himself from the war. But because he is separate from the war as a lieutenant, you know, one of his men dies, Ted Lavender. And so that's a moment of catharsis that moves him towards a juncture of epiphanic juncture. And, you know, the letters are a totem. He burns them. He burns this sort of fantastical mindset and marches his men off to the village of Tanque to burn it to the ground. Because, you know, they need he needs to be there for his men, and he needs to, as he sees it, sort of like atone for his behavior that's resulted in loss. And so, you know, you see this engaged in other ways as well. It's not just an object like letters or a magic feather or whatever else, an orange. It could be more echo points, right? Like in the Alice Munro story, Miles City, Montana, you know, it has all these images of water. Like, it opens up with this group of searchers coming back from the reservoir because a kid has been missing, and they're carrying the drowned body of the kid. Later on, there's a moment on a turkey farm where a flood has happened. Floodwaters are rising, and these turkeys are all up on this knoll of dirt, and they're turning around and around and around as the water encroaches upon them. And there's several other moments as well. And they're all building towards this moment at the end where the mother is on this road trip, the mother who is the point of view character, and she has her kids with her, and they stop in Miles City, Montana, and there's a pool there. And the lifeguard is a teenager who's not really paying attention, and nobody's at the pool. And she lets her kids go in there while she gets lunch ready. And by the time she comes to the pool, she finds her kid face down in the deep end. And you realize that it's all been building towards that moment. And so, yeah, the way in which you can think of, you know, as juggling, you can think of it as a kind of turnstile approach, but you have these things, and maybe it's one thing, maybe it's many things that are just cycling through your story, and every time that they pass through your hands, they sort of become more weighted and important.
Do you, when you're working on a book or a story or whatever, are you barreling through the first draft and then, you know, sort of getting it all down and then going back and doing sort of a vertical fill or filling out, embellishing, you know, all the smaller but as important elements?
Well, I described to you the way in which I outline, blueprint, yeah, fill up those scrolls on the wall. As a result of that, I write pretty speedily because I have that skeleton already before me. Mm-hmm. But it's more a case of constant refinement for me. So I oftentimes begin the day reworking what I had written previously. If it's a short story, you know, I'm beginning from page one again and moving forward. If it's a novel, I'm probably beginning at the beginning of the chapter that I was working on. And so it's sort of like refine, like a stone turned over in a river until it's polished. It's not that I don't go back once I finish and rework it and rework it again, but I'm trying to move towards a first draft that is actually more like a fourth draft because of the way in which I approach it.
Mm. Yeah, I can see where that scroll on the wall and doing some degree of outlining could make the whole enterprise a bit more streamlined, you know?
But, you know, I should say that in part, this is superstition that I do it. It's my own magic feather from Dumbo, in that I wrote four failed novels before publishing my first novel, The Wild End. And almost every writer will tell you the same thing. They've got, you know, those books in the drawer that they had to write to get to the book that worked. And The Wilding was the first book that I outlined in advance. And because, so ever since then, I've just had this superstitious feeling that this is what I have to do. I probably don't need to anymore. It's probably instinctual at this point. Nonetheless, that's how I work. And you know, if I'm working on a short story or something, I don't do that. I don't outline short stories. I view them as much more impressionistic. And that's part of the joy of writing them.
So the four failed novels, did they fail because they were all over the place? Did they fail in your eyes or somebody else's eyes? I mean, why do you consider them failed?
Oh, a number of reasons. I mean, each one got better than the last. Mm-hmm. So you could say clumsy characterization and crappy writing in the first one. But towards the end, it was more structural, I think. Mm-hmm. So I'd written a book called The Mystery Light. For instance, this is the last book, the last failed book before The Wilding. And my agent sent it all around New York and everybody passed on it. And the thing that they said was like, wow, you know, Ben can really write. And I'd published a bunch of short stories and such and articles. So I had confidence. I had heat. They're like, Ben can write, but right now he can't write a novel. And I actually got I got blue and, you know, drank some whiskey and listened to some Coltrane and felt bad for myself for a while. And then that night I, you know, actually deleted the manuscript. But the next day, you know, I woke up and I pulled the manuscript out of the trash on my computer and looked at it again. I kind of realized that what I was doing was I was writing short stories as chapters. Mm. So there's kind of like this start, stop, quality to the book. And I hadn't realized how to organize the tension. And I was doing this thing where I would introduce trouble and resolve trouble in every chapter. And so what I started doing then was what I had done as a grad student and undergrad with short stories. And that is to really start rereading them and mapping them out and trying to figure out how they ticked. I hadn't done the same thing with novels. So I started mapping out novels that I read, rereading them and figuring out their component parts and figuring out different organizational structures. And at the same time, I was teaching a novel writing class and I felt like a bit of a fraud doing so because I hadn't published a novel of my own. And that really clarified a lot of things for me and informed the outline that I put together and helped me to sell that first novel, The Wilding. So yeah, that's sort of where my mindset was.
Hmm. Interesting. Yeah. Well, obviously the early stuff got you an agent. So,
short stories. Yeah. The short story stuff got me the agent.
Hmm. Before we go, I wanted to ask you one more thing about Thrill Me. We could talk for hours. I think I have so much I haven't talked to you about, but, I just once again, really want to, hope our listeners check out Thrill Me Essays on Fiction, because it's such a good book on craft and writing. But you talk about tone. You say tone refers not only to voice, but to music, the foot tapping rhythm of the words. Dialogue is typically staccato, while narrative is typically legato. Could you say a bit about that?
Sure. There's the voice of the characters, and then there's the voice of the book. I'm, speaking more so about third person, but you have, you know, this control as author, and that control of voice, right? There's a way the book sounds, and the narration might explore the setting. The narration might explore the theme. The narration might explore the inner worlds of these characters. And then you have like these interrupted bursts of language, because the way that people speak generally is not in paragraphs, but in sort of like broken little clusters. And so I refer to that as, you know, a staccato rhythm. And if you look at a book in general, if you like, I'm saying, just don't read it, just look at it, pick up a book and flip, you know, flip the pages. You'll see this sort of like compression, expansion. And in a way, that same sort of variation applies to what I'm talking about too earlier when I was saying, okay, when I look at this map of my story, when I try to break it down like sheet music, I'm actually going over it and showing where the rises and falls are. So I'm like, okay, this is a crescendo. And this is a valley, like a more emotive moment. And here's this, you know, crazy bank robbery or whatever. That's a crescendo. And here's this moment where afterwards the characters are, you know, maybe they've got a bullet wound. Maybe they lost one of the members of the gang. Maybe the bag of money that they stole exploded in an ink blast, whatever. Like they're thinking about what happened and planning what's going to go next. That's a down moment and so on. So there's that. And this applies to essays as well. Like, okay, the way a standard essay or memoir or work is, it's like same way a novel might work. Like something will happen and then there'll be some thoughts about it. Tell us a story, have some thoughts about it. Tell us some story, have some thoughts about it. So I'm talking about all these different things that are essentially doing the same thing, which is expansion, contraction, variation. And that variation is what keeps a song interesting. It's what keeps a story interesting.
Hmm. Yeah, I love it. Love it. Well, we are at the end of our time. I wonder if you have any last words or pearls of wisdom for the writers listening who may
be. Yeah, well, just, you know, building off of something I was saying before. I taught for a while. I was a nerdy professor in my previous life before I went full-time at the keyboard. And the most valuable assignment my students always said came from out of our workshops was this. And it stems from my own experience. I would assign them a story. And I asked them to read that story six times. And the next time that they read it, the seventh time, let's say, they would have a legal tablet beside them and they would map out the beats of that story, because they would be emotionally detached from it at that point. They would be able to view it wholly on a technical basis. So maybe paragraph one introduces character A and that character's central weakness via dialogue. If it's a Flannery O'Connor story, let's say the character might be revealed through the dialogue to be jealous and spiteful, which is every Flannery O'Connor character. Mm-hmm. Paragraph two, theme introduced via description of setting. If it's a Flannery O'Connor story, maybe it's like a grubby neighborhood that has fallen into disrepair. Or maybe if it's a Cormac McCarthy story, it's some sort of description of the jawline of the mountains and there's a sense of despair and ruin, whatever. You know what the thematics are because you've read the story so many times. So you map it out beat by beat by beat by beat. And then I would tell my students, all right, I want you to write a story based on this outline, based on the skeleton. And then after you do that, I want you to write an essay and give a presentation to the class as to why you made every single move in this story that was generated from your analysis of the first. Mm. And this exercise is no different than what the painter does when they go into a museum and set up an easel before, say, a Van Gogh or a Gauguin and try to replicate the brushstrokes. It's no different than what the athlete does when they watch hours and hours and hours of footage And then they go to the free throw line or they go to the batting cage and try to replicate what they've seen the masters do.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so what I'm advocating is being a slow reader and an intentional reader to further your own storytelling.
Mm. Yeah, it's great. It's a great assignment. Oh, man. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk today.
Yeah, thank you for having me on. And
you're welcome.
Helping get the word out on The Unfamiliar Garden.
Yeah, yeah. Wonderful book. I do want to read the others because it's interesting doing a series with, you know, as you said, the other two are in different parts of the world. Yeah, interesting. So the first one is out and this is the second.
That's right.
And so the third one is coming when?
Coming soon-ish. I'm actually trying to finish it right now.
Okay. Thanks so much.
Hey, thank you.
That was Benjamin Percy, author of The Unfamiliar Garden. You can find out more about the show and so much else on my website, penonfire.com. Drop us a line. We like to hear from you. Now, get some writing done.